loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss the announcement by Donald Trump and the U.S. government that the United States will be pulling out of the landmark Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. We're going to talk about what its impact is on U.S.-Russian relations, especially what it means for China and what it means for the new global arms race. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations in the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Chris Garafa takes us through the big stories of the week when it comes to technology issues.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, thousands of Central American migrants have entered southern Mexico on their way to the United States, despite President Trump's exhortations that they are, quote, criminals, unquote. The president also threatened to cut off aid to any country associated with the caravan and not working hard enough to stop it. It appears that Donald Trump and the Republicans are, in fact, happy about this event and are trying to manipulate the optics for their own political benefit. Next, today we begin a daily segment on politics that will run until Election Day on November 6th. We'll tell you about the closest and most important races around the country and the issues that affect those races. Then, the story behind the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi continues to become more and more bizarre every day. Turkish authorities released a photograph yesterday of a man who apparently had been part of the team that killed Khashoggi, leaving the Saudi consulate wearing the victim's clothes. Meanwhile, Turkish President Erdogan says that he will release in the next 48 hours all of the information his government has collected in the case. That is sure to be a major embarrassment to the Saudi government. President Trump's critics have spent the past 17 months anticipating what some expect to be among the most thrilling events of their lives: Special Counsel Robert Mueller's final report on Russian intervention in the 2016 presidential election. But they'll likely be disappointed. At least that's what Politico is hearing from defense attorneys working on the probe and other experts. Meanwhile, a Russian woman has been charged in federal court in the Eastern District of Virginia for allegedly trying to influence the upcoming midterm elections by creating fake Facebook accounts. And finally, today, we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, the Trump administration's Department of Health and Human Services is working to redefine gender as a permanent fixture based on biological sex organs at birth. The move is part of an effort by the Trump administration to roll back and eliminate earlier measures adopted during the Obama administration that recognized the civil and social rights of transgender people in the United States. After a memo from HHS leaked yesterday, hundreds of protesters marched on the White House today. King Abdullah of Jordan is taking steps to recover Jordanian territory now owned by private Israeli interests. These lands were leased for 25 years under a 1994 peace deal, and the king has said his country will not renew it. This comes in retaliation for a number of Israeli expansionist moves, including the enlargement of settlements and the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Afghanistan held elections yesterday, which will take up to 20 days to count and report preliminary results on. The province of Kandahar will hold delayed elections later on after a police chief and two American officials were shot in an attack last Thursday. It was also confirmed today that one of the Americans injured in the attack was U.S. Army Brigadier General Jeffrey Smiley. Eduardo Bolsonaro, the son of far-right Brazilian presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro and a newly elected member of parliament, insinuated yesterday that there would be a military coup if the country's Supreme Electoral Court took action against his father. The court is investigating a scandal surrounding the illegal spread of fake news supporting Bolsonaro on the popular messaging app WhatsApp. Eduardo Bolsonaro said that it would take, quote, one soldier and a corporal, unquote, to close the Supreme Court and added, quote, what is the Supreme Court, man? Take away the power of the pen of a judge on the court? What is he then on the street? Unquote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the decision by the Trump administration to leave to exit the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF. President Trump announced over the weekend that he would withdraw the United States from that treaty, a decades-old agreement signed in 1987 between President Ronald Reagan and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Trump said that Russia had not honored the agreement, but NATO allies expressed shock at the announcement and said they were not consulted. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. And we're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. That has a question mark on it. I think Jude is going to take the question mark off in the next edition. Jude and Mark, welcome back.
Brian, John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Mark. Jude, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mark Sloboda, at the time of the signing of the INF, it was shortly after the United States, under the Reagan administration, the Pentagon, decided to place in Europe intermediate-range tactical nuclear weapons that had a flight time of about 6 minutes to their targets, and their targets were most of the political offices of the Soviet Communist Party and other Russian Soviet government and Soviet military installations. There was a huge anti-war movement in Europe at that time. Finally, there was the meeting in Reykjavik and in Iceland between Gorbachev and Reagan, after which the INF treaty was signed. It was a big deal then. Is it a big deal that the United States is essentially ending compliance with the INF?
Yes and no. It was a big deal then. We have to remember that the geopolitical context was quite different. Europe was divided. Half of Europe was Russia's ally, then the Soviet Union under the Warsaw Pact. And I think there was more respect for each other on both sides. There wasn't this untrammeled belief in U.S. power and authority in the world, and there wasn't the conventional military mismatch that we see today with the U.S. having enormous conventional power or spending 11 times more than Russia on its military and so on. The geopolitical boundaries have been reduced. The technology is also quite different. We're now in an era of land and sea-based launched cruise missiles, which are not covered in the INF treaty. It's perfectly legal. We have multiple power centers with China, South Korea, Japan, the UK, France, all having these types of capabilities and not being a party to this agreement, putting Russia and the U.S. at a comparative disadvantage. And, you know, we have a host of other new weapons, hypersonic missiles, hypersonic glide vehicles, all of these things that are not covered in this type of intermediate range nuclear forces treaty. And most importantly, since the United States unilaterally withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2001, Russia has made perfectly clear that the INF treaty, in retrospect of that pullout, is really not that much a benefit to Russia's strategic interests.
That's Mark Sloboda. We're talking to Mark from Moscow. We're also joined on the line by Jude Woodward. Jude is talking to us from London. Jude, you've written a book about U.S.-Chinese relations. I'm looking at the Global Times, a newspaper that's not the official organ of the Chinese Communist Party. It's privately owned, but oftentimes referred to as a media outlet that reflects at least some of the official views in China. The headline of this editorial is Washington quitting INF, that's the Intermediate Nuclear Missile Treaty, will lead to historic setback. I'm going to read a couple sentences to you from this Global Times article. It says, the Soviet Union could stand up to the U.S. as an equal when the INF was signed, but today, Washington's increasingly disregards Russia and hurries to get rid of the treaty. The U.S. withdrawal would aggravate the strategic imbalance in today's world. It could trigger a global arms race and add to instability, blah, blah, blah. Then it goes on later, and this is where I want to get your comment. Not unexpectedly, Trump mentioned China in his withdrawal decision. The INF treaty is binding for only the U.S. and Russia, although China has exercised restraint in developing strategic weaponry with no intention of nuclear power competition. the U.S. still fixes its eyes on China doubtfully. And then the article goes on to say China's rise is based on basically and essentially an economic rise, not a military confrontation with the West. But let's I want to get your opinion. How does the exit of the INF treaty, basically the scuttling of the treaty, impact China?
Well, I think directly very little, indirectly possibly a lot. Directly very little, because really it doesn't apply to China. And if the US was seriously concerned that it needed to have short-range missiles based to confront China, then it could put, as the previous, your previous interviewee said, do these from sea and air-based launched missiles, which would have the same impact, or it could get persuade Japan or South Korea to it could agree with them to base nuclear missiles there. That would obviously lead to a political crisis with China, but the treaty itself doesn't make any difference to whether it could do that or not. It's political consideration. So the treaty really makes very little difference to what America's military and nuclear missile options are in the region. The danger is that it's really just a signal. It's not specifically the terms of the treaty that matter in relation to China. It's an indication that the US intends to engage in a weapons buildup, including a nuclear weapons buildup aimed at China, which will be a very serious destabilizing geopolitical step.
Makes sense to me. What do you think, Mark?
Well, first of all, I think we're already in an arms race. We have been in an arms race since the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and there are multiple pulls this time. It's not just the U.S. and Russia. It's the U.S. and Russia and China and India and the European countries, the U.K. and France at least, and some other countries around the world. So we are already in an arms race. And new technological weapons have already reduced the flight time. Russia recently showcased its hypersonic missiles, which it felt it had to develop to maintain their strategic deterrent in the face of U.S. anti-ballistic missile defense placed in Europe and South Korea and Japan and so on. Secondly, well, first of all, I think it's true that the U.S. could put intermediate range nuclear weapons if it wanted to in any future conflict with China in the South China Sea, Taiwan, etc., via sea and air-launched missiles. However, there is a certain reliability factor that comes with land-based missile launchers, and the U.S. Army, which does not have the capability. You have to remember that the three U.S. military branches often compete with each other for assets and resources and functions. They are very hot to put tactical nuclear weapons in Guam and Japan for use against in any future conflict with China. The Army sees that is the motion of future U.S. conflict, and they want to make sure that they are involved in something that is would primarily otherwise be sea and air launch thing. So there's a little bit of military branch politics going along with this.
Jude Woodward, at the time that the U.S. placed the intermediate range nuclear missiles in Europe, thus ringing the Soviet Union with missiles that could reach their targets, as I said in the beginning, in about six minutes, land-based missiles. There was when we look back at this period, and when the policymakers look back at the period, they basically give kudos to Ronald Reagan for having applied the full court press, maximum pressure on the Soviet Union, at the very same time that China was being integrated into the world economy and functioning more or less as a political ally of the U.S., the Soviet Union felt isolated, it felt threatened, it felt encircled. And I think there was an estimate within the policy establishment that this full court press helped create fissures and factional divisions within the Soviet Communist Party, ultimately, you know, as they look back, that led to the breakup of the Soviet Union. In other words, a form of maximum pressure. Do you believe that the United States policy towards China is similarly rooted, that the U.S. feels by putting maximum pressure on China that it can create some sort of split or division within China that could lead to, as the U.S. undoubtedly hopes, as it did with the Soviet Union, even if it was surprised by the actual outcome, the breakup of the existing political rule of the Chinese Communist Party in China?
Well, that's undoubtedly and unquestionably the aim of the U.S. military foreign policy establishment. However, the situation is extremely different. The Soviet Union's economy was in severe problems from the mid-1970s. And by the time Reagan was applying the policy of maximum military pressure, which the Soviet Union responded to initially by engaging in that arms race which put even worse pressure on the Soviet economy, you had a dramatically weakening situation internally. That's not the situation with China. China, even though its growth slowed due to some pressures in the situation, is still one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It's probably the largest, economy in the world measured in purchasing power parity terms as opposed to exchange rate terms. And this is a totally different type of nut to crack. And it will not be so easy to create those kinds of fissures. But obviously, that is the aim of the United States. Whether walking out of this treaty aids that or not, I seriously question, because it's one thing possibly to station missiles in Guam. It's an entirely different thing to station missiles in Japan. And just look what happened in Europe when Ronald Reagan stationed cruise missiles in Europe. There was the most enormous anti-missiles, anti-nuclear movement developed in Europe because Europe believed it had been turned into a target. And Japanese people will feel exactly the same thing. And so the political ramifications of trying to take a step like that are enormous. So while there's no doubt what the US's intentions are and have been for some time, that is not new, not signalled by this walkout. Whether this walkout from this particular treaty makes a substantial difference is not clear to me.
That's Jude Woodward. We're also talking to Mark Sloboda. Jude is talking to us from London. Mark is talking to us from Moscow. Mark, when we think back about nuclear arms deals in the past, we had the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty of 1969, the START 1 Treaty, the SALT Treaty, the attempted SALT II, which got scuttled during the Carter administration, then START 1, START 2, the anti-ballistic missile treaty between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and Soviet Union. All of these treaties, each and every one of them is conditioned based on a military understanding from both sides that the continuance of the old status quo wasn't gaining either side a military benefit, and thus you could cap a weapons program or reduce a weapons program or even scrap a weapons program because it no longer really was militarily necessary. In other words, the treaties have never been simply an expression of peace or an expression of, it's been an expression of a military reality as well. Does this, do you agree with that? And two, how does this play out given the cancellation of INF?
Yeah, I think this is you are dead on set with this one as well, except for this reason. It's the military realities, new technologies, new geopolitical contexts that have demanded that have led the U.S. to pull out of it. Now, both Russia and the U.S. have for years now made accusations that the other is violating the treaty. Russia has a few objections. The most substantial and credible of them, in my mind, is that the U.S. has placed its anti-ballistic missile shield with MK-41 launchers in Romania. These are the same launchers, an ashore version of the Aegis system, of their normal sea-based variant, which is not forbidden by this treaty. And as the Aegis on ships can fire cruise missiles, Russian military engineers have, you know, analyzed and said that this could very easily, in a very short period of time, be retrofitted to fire intermediate-range cruise missiles, potentially tipped with nuclear warheads, based in Europe at Russia. And those launchers, of course, are also forbidden by the treaty, as are the missiles. U.S. complains that Russia has developed a land-based variant of the Caliber sea-launched cruise missile, legal under the treaty, which Russia has recently demonstrated to great effect in Syria, launching it from as far away as the Caspian Sea. They say that its ranges fall within the intermediate range treaty. Russia says, no, they don't. They fall outside the ranges of the treaty. And one of the things that's not understood about the treaty is both sides have long-range nuclear missiles. This really isn't about a threat against each other. Russia isn't threatened by U.S. intermediate range missiles and vice versa. This is, the treaty was all founded about Europe because they both have long range missiles pointed at each other. And you can always target a much longer range intercontinental ballistic missile at a shorter range target if you wanted to. So this, I think, really is far more about China than it is about Russia. This dispute could be resolved. Transparency on one side, allow Russia to investigate the interceptors in Romania, allow the U.S. to be there during testing of Russia's of this missile, the 9M729, if they wanted to. And there is indeed an investigative commission within the protocols for this treaty, but the treaty is outdated. It doesn't include the major players of the world today, and it doesn't address the technological realities of this era. I think that while Russia protests about the U.S. unilaterally pulling out of another treaty and making the world more dangerous, they're secretly quite happy with the U.S. pulling out of this treaty and taking the political heat for it. And I think they see an opportunity, and it's even possible that this is the motivation on the Trump side as well, or at least one of the selling points, is the opportunity to draw other countries in and craft a new, modern, truly international arms control agreement.
Interesting. We're going to come back to that if we can. Jude Woodward, that was Mark Sloboda talking to us from Moscow. Jude Woodward is talking to us from London. I'm looking at The Hill newspaper. It's an article that came out 2 days ago. It's one of many, many, many media stories about this. But I'm raising it because it comes back to your point, which is, and it's kind of echoing what Mark is saying too, that it may not really have a military consequence, but the announcement by the U.S. at this time, at least as regards China, has a political impact and as such is in some ways a political statement. But there's a military side to all of these politics. And the headline from The Hill is U.S. mulls sending warships through Taiwan Strait amid China tensions. This would not be the first time, but I'll read you the first sentence or two and then get you to comment. The United States is now weighing a new operation to send warships through the Taiwan Straits, American officials told Reuters early Saturday. The operation, which would guarantee, quote, free passage, close quote, through a key waterway, could ratchet up already high tensions with China, the outlet noted. This is the second time in recent months that the same thing happened back in July. China was extremely upset because China, Jude Woodward, considers this to be provocation after provocation. Go ahead.
Well, it is provocation after provocation. I mean, there's no threat to freedom of navigation through the Straits of Taiwan. This is just an excuse to send American warships sort of 60, 70 miles off the Chinese coast, and that is extremely provocative. Any country would find that provocative, and so it will certainly lead to a ratcheting up of tensions. What the US wants to do is establish its right to patrol China's coastline. China will not accept that, so we will have to see what happens. it will have a moderate response to the US sending one warship on one occasion, although it will make clear how angry it is about it. But if this becomes a sort of set of routine exercises to send warships through the Straits of Taiwan, this will lead to a serious ratcheting up of military tensions. It's not clear what China will do, because as from the article you read in Global Times is exactly accurate, China is not interested in a military confrontation with the United States or with anyone else. What it wants is to be able to continue to develop its economy and to improve the standard of living of its people and to contribute to creating a global trade situation that is felicitous for that and for other countries that also want to trade. But on the other hand, it is not going to sit idly by while a huge military buildup takes place around its coasts.
Mark Sloboda, we have 2 minutes left. When you think about it from a Chinese point of view, the exercise of gunboat diplomacy, and that's what we're witnessing, referring, of course, to the pursuit of foreign policy objectives with the aid of conspicuous displays of naval power, something that affected countries all over the world, from Greece in the mid-19th century, but certainly to China. Given that history, let's just help the audience understand how China is going to understand and perceive and react to gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah, this has a real bad historical context in Asia, the history of the U.S. threatening other countries with naval military force, and it's not going to be accepted well by a China that is feeling its strength economically and military and being provoked at the same time. As a U.S. Navy veteran, let me just say that this freedom of navigation needs to be called out for the pretext and nonsense it is. China has in no way ever impeded the navigation or trade of any international waters near its borders. It vitally depends on global trade, resources coming in, finished products coming out for its economy and national development, which is its primary concern. This is a blatant excuse for a U.S. threatening show of force in what they have announced is their containment of China. China reacts to this constriction by increasing its own military force because it needs to ensure that it always does have its freedom of passage in its own waters, because its economy and internal development and politics depend so much on it. So this, provocation, freedom of navigation cannot be allowed to become a pretext for routine naval parades off of other countries' coasts on the other side of the world, you know, as a threatening gesture. And then that's exactly what this excuse has become. And, you know, China's policy of building up selected reefs in the South China Sea, something that, first of all, is not done only by China, but by U.S. allies in this context, the Philippines, Vietnam, and others. It was done by other countries, and it was done by them first. And China only then reacted, although albeit in a bigger way, as a sense of defending its own trade routes, which, again, international trade.
We're going to leave it there. That was the voice of Mark Sloboda. Mark was talking to us from Moscow. Mark is an international relations and security analyst. And we were joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of numerous articles and books. Her latest book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We are joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Brian and John, good to be back as always.
Thank you. Wow, we're looking at a lineup here of at least 10 big technology stories. Chris, where do you want to start?
You know, I want to start with Twitter. Last week, Twitter released a section of their website called Elections Integrity. And they claim that Twitter's focus, this is the big headline, right? Twitter's focus is on a healthy public conversation. So what Twitter did last week was release huge archives of tweets and accounts that they claim are associated with the IRA, the Internet Research Agency that we've heard so much about in this Russiagate scandal. So I went and downloaded these tweets. They did this for Russia and Iran. I was only able to do the Russia tweets, and I plan to do the Iran stuff this week. But I've got some interesting statistics here where they're really blowing up this idea that Russia is somehow going to, or, you know, did interfere in the 2016 elections and somehow might be interfering in the midterm elections coming up. So I've got some analysis that I've done on this. So first, they targeted 3,836 accounts, but Twitter has 68 million monthly active users just in the U.S., and it has 336 million worldwide. So this is a tiny little percentage of Twitter users that they say were somehow impacting elections.
Let's say the numbers again.
So in terms of accounts, it's 3,836.
Out of how many?
Out of 336 million worldwide Twitter users.
What is that? That's point something. There's several zeros before you get to the one here.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, looking further into these accounts, 266 of them didn't even have any followers. And the vast majority, 3,276, had fewer than 1,000 followers. So these accounts had very little reach, really. Some of the biggest ones were called the Moscow Bulletin with 257,000 followers, the Petersburg Bulletin with 149,000, and an account called the GOP Tennessee Unofficial with 147,000 accounts. Okay, so those are the most. I mean, Donald Trump has millions of followers, and we're talking about maximum 257,000 here. So they also gave us access to over 9 million tweets. But here's the thing, Twitter has over 500 million tweets per day. So they're focusing on these 9 million tweets going back to the year 2009, when Twitter has 500 million tweets a day at least. So 172 of those accounts never even tweeted. 2,100 of them had 1,000 or fewer tweets. And a lot of these tweets, the top 26 tweets that were actually reused were in Russian, and they were talking about, you know, Russian news, or they were talking about just Russian culture, or, you know, local news. So something that happened locally in St. Petersburg or Moscow or Vladivostok.
I'm unclear, Chris, as to what exactly the crime is here.
The crime apparently is being Russian on Twitter, apparently.
Yeah, that's what it looked like to me.
I was reading some of the, trying to, not as much as you, Chris, but reading some of the sort of getting beneath the headlines, it looks like whoever these Twitter accounts were, whoever they are in terms of proprietorship, they're aiming largely at Russian-speaking people, perhaps
exactly,
in the United States and elsewhere. Like
exactly,
that kind of makes sense. It wouldn't be like spreading chaos in America if you're like looking to, you know, sell things or influence or get followers from Russian Americans, of whom there are a number, or Russian-speaking people living outside of Russia, of whom there are even many more.
But in the U.S., according to the 2010 census, there's only 855,000 Russian speakers in the U.S. It's the 12th most spoken language in the United States. So fewer than a million people speak Russian, according to, again, the 2010 U.S. census. And I want to actually thank Walter, the producer over there, for reminding us that on Friday, very non-coincidentally timed, I think, with this dump, there was a criminal complaint against a Russian citizen who lives in Russia, who will never have to answer in a U.S. court, about some sort of, you know, collusion and attempting to interfere in the elections. Now, the midterms are coming up in just a few weeks, and it's very clear that this Twitter dump, Facebook stuff in the last few weeks, and these charges against a Russian citizen are all tied into this anti-Russia campaign that especially the Democrats and some anti-Trump Republicans are still pushing really hard as the reasons that that Trump won.
Yeah, I actually read, John, the criminal complaint against this Russian woman. It's filed, I think, in the Eastern District of
Virginia. Right, which is known as the espionage court, by the way.
Yeah, and her name is Elena Kushianova, 44 years old, from St. Petersburg. She's an accountant. She did the books for, I guess it's the Lakhta Group or something like that, of which the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, now famous or infamous. I read the criminal complaint. It's like, and then there was a Facebook page under the name of such and such a person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a really thin gruel. We're going to do it. Chris, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we're doing another segment in today's Loud and Clear that focuses more on that. But I think I'm glad you raised the Twitter story, because when you look at the facts, how many tweets were they? Who were they really aimed at? What was their influence? Did they have thematic sort of consistency or coherence? You cannot come away if you have an objective faculty. In other words, if you're not part of the anti-Russia witch hunt, if you have an objective faculty, you can't come away and say, this is evidence that Russia is using Twitter to sow chaos in America.
I completely agree. And even if this was some big plot, it had a very, very poor reach. Just before we move on to the next story, a couple more things that I came upon through this data analysis. The Tennessee GOP page, one of those top pages with the followers, was their tweets were like just over 7 million times. That's over 10,000, almost 11,000 tweets. But that's going back to 2015. Donald Trump got 7 million likes on Twitter since October 13th of this year. His last 95 tweets. If we look at some news sources, CNN gets 106,000 likes in 2 days. Fox News gets 126,000 likes in 2 days. So even if this were some big Russian conspiracy, they would have executed it very poorly in this case.
Important numbers. I think because people read the headlines, they react to headlines, the headlines feed off of each other. It's kind of an echo chamber. So people are just left. And again, people's eyes glaze over because it's been almost 2 years now. 2 years? Yeah, it's been 2 years of the Russia investigation, more than 2 years, actually. Yeah, people don't really know the facts, but the facts actually speak volumes here. Let's go on to the next story, Chris.
So there was a video that has since been taken down. It was hosted on Dropbox for Amazon's new Ring police portal for video surveillance. So Amazon's Ring is a internet-connected doorbell and video camera. So the idea would be that you're sitting at home or you're not at home and somebody rings your doorbell and you get a video stream of who's at your door. Sounds like it could be good for safety, especially if you're home alone. It's at night. You want to see who's at your door. But Amazon has built a police portal for video surveillance footage from these. And the police can go through and they can request footage from a specific time from everyone in your neighborhood. Now, individual people do have to consent to giving that specific information and that video out, you know, over to the police. But I think in many cases where we've seen, just racist terror from neighborhood watch groups and the like, that's going to be given over to police. And you have to piece together the video, maybe of somebody driving down the street at the same time as a crime supposedly occurred, that has person probably has nothing to do with it. But if they seem out of place, it's going to be very scary for what the police are going to do. And these cameras can read license plates relatively clearly. They can do facial recognition along with the police software. And so this is going to be very scary for issues of policing in the United States.
John, this is important because last week we had the announcement that Amazon was taking this $10 billion contract with the Pentagon, using Amazon Web Services in order to function as an adjunct, really, or a part of the military-industrial complex. It has the $600 million contract already with the CIA some of the same services. And now, as a matter of convenience and keeping us safe, in other words, we install this technology at our door so that we can see who's at the door when wherever we are, also feeding, I think, people's paranoia.
Sure.
Because most of the people doing this are not in so-called high-crime areas. No. They're like in suburban, whatever. But people are doing this. They're sort of going along with the program while Amazon is, in essence, merging with the police, in essence, merging with the Pentagon, in essence, merging with the CIA. So we have a fusion of the biggest monopoly corporations with the state for surveillance.
Yes.
And, of course, they have to say, it's for our safety. Dangerous stuff.
Yeah, but nobody pays any attention to the Fourth Amendment. You know, it's as though they want us to be grateful that they're doing something like this and taking away our freedoms. I mean, they're essentially spying on us and then telling us at the same time that it's for our own good.
Yeah, and just think about what Chris was saying, that they're saying you have to give consent, but the police are able to put a lot of pressure on people under certain circumstances, so they give consent.
Yes.
And then we also come to the issue that we've talked about before with like the Amazon Echo devices, where can the police subpoena for that video? And if they can subpoena for the video, then can they subpoena to see when you come in and out of your home, to track where you are, not just what happened on the street or on the sidewalk in front of your home.
Yeah, absolutely true. Should we go on to the next one?
Yeah, actually, I want to stick with Amazon actually for a minute. And there's a great piece on Medium. It's called "I'm an Amazon Employee. My company shouldn't sell face recognition tech to police." This is an anonymous op-ed, but has been verified by Medium's editorial staff as from an actual Amazon employee. And this employee points out that a week or so ago, 450 employees delivered a letter to Jeff Bezos and other Amazon executives demanding first that it stop selling its facial recognition product called Recognition to police departments. And this is part of that facial recognition that I was talking about just a minute ago, but also that it kick Palantir, a private company that effectively powers so much of ICE's tracking and deportation system, off of Amazon Web Services, which is this like service that, you know, really it's the cloud, right? Palantir uses Amazon servers and Amazon software to power this massive database for ICE that they're using to terrorize immigrant populations in the U.S. to track deportations and to track where people are. So I really, you know, appreciate this op-ed, and I want to call out a couple key phrases and sentences. If we want to lead, we need to make a choice between people and profits. Amazon is making millions off of recognition. It's making millions off of its partnerships with the Defense Department and other police agencies and federal agencies. Another quote, we know from history that new and powerful surveillance tools left unchecked in the hands of the state have been used to target people who have done nothing wrong. In the United States, a lack of public accountability already results in outsized impacts and over-policing of communities of color, immigrants, and people exercising their First Amendment rights. So kudos to this Amazon employee for writing this. I certainly hope there is no, if they are found out, that there's no backlash against them and that people will stand up and other employees will join this employee and the other 450 who delivered that letter to Amazon executives demanding that the company that they work for stop supporting this awful government oppression and surveillance.
Yeah, I like the idea of these anonymous op-eds. You know, we saw this famous one in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about the Trump White House. Now, this one in Medium, which was really quite well done and frankly was a warning call. I would call this author a whistleblower. And I'd like to thank whoever it was that wrote it.
Oh, hopefully they start listening to Loud and Clear and they can...
Yeah, seriously, right?
They can know that we're thanking them for sure.
Hey, one of the important things that we talked about in our staff meeting today was an article that you've also flagged for us about Israel's cyber spy industry. The Israelis are notorious for being willing to work for literally anybody on the planet, no matter how horrible or how ruthless they are. And you flagged a very important article. Tell us about that.
This is from Haaretz. It was released on Friday, and the outlines how Israeli tech companies are working with governments all across the world to basically track and install spyware and do awful things with people who are struggling for human rights. So the big example it gives is a Mexican human rights activist who does a lot of research into the disappeared. You know, there have been hundreds of thousands of people just disappeared in Mexico over the past few decades, including one of the most popular examples or the most well-known is the Ayotzinapa 43, these, you know, students who were just disappeared while they were on a bus. Now, this activist got a text message with some broken links, and they sounded like it was people that wanted his help, saying things like, please help me with my brother. The police took him only because he's a teacher. And then he's also a part-time teacher as well. So he got one saying, professor, I encountered a problem. I'm sending back my thesis, which is based on your dissertation, so you can give me your comments. And so these messages, right, they look legitimate. They look real. That's something a human rights activist or a teacher could get. The problem is the links were appeared to be broken to him, so appeared that they didn't work. What happened when he clicked the links was that there was spyware installed automatically onto his phone. And so that turned his phone, as this article says, into a surveillance device in the hands of the Mexican government. So they were fake text messages sent by the Mexican government or agents of it that installed spyware on his phone. And the way they do this is that the Israeli companies that sold the Mexican government these tools know about vulnerabilities in software and hardware before even the companies know. So let's say he was using an iPhone. They're going to know about, and they found vulnerabilities and haven't told Apple about them, which should be criminal neglect right there. And they exploit them to be able to provide this service. And there are many, many other examples. Their governments across the world are using the services of a number of these companies that are based in Israel, which has a booming tech sector. But they're being used in countries like Bahrain and Mozambique and Azerbaijan and Bangladesh and Nicaragua, all over the world. And in some cases, in the UAE, for example, they're being used to figure out who's gay and how to target them and how to shame them, and effectively threaten them. And the Israeli government, the Knesset, basically says, well, there's nothing we can do about this. They're private companies.
Wow. That's frightening. I wonder if there are American companies doing the same thing. And is any of that even legal in the United States?
It is legal in the United States, and there are many American companies that do the same thing. Now, I want to go back. We've often talked about the San Bernardino case where Apple stood up to the federal government, the FBI, and said, we're not going to unlock this phone. But that phone did get unlocked. And that, in that case, was another Israeli company, Cellebrite, that makes devices that police agencies in the U.S. use. They plug a phone into it, and the device does all this, stuff to back up the phone and try to crack it without triggering the safety precautions in the phone itself. And so the police departments in the U.S. and the federal government are using these technologies. Absolutely.
Wow.
Let's go on, Chris, to another story. Let's talk about the net neutrality investigation.
Wow. Yeah. Big news. So the New York Attorney General has subpoenaed more than a dozen telecommunications trade groups and lobbyists and basically people and organizations representing the major communications companies, because when there was an open comment period on the FCC's website last year regarding net neutrality, the FCC said the majority of the comments they got were in favor of a repeal of net neutrality, except Stanford did a study on the comments and found that millions of these comments were actually fake. They were using fake names, fake email addresses. In some cases, they were using dead people, the names of people who had been deceased for some time to submit these comments. And so when you actually filter out, and the report is called Filtering Out the Bots, and it's a great great title and a very important report to read, it turns out that the people who actually submitted, quote, real comments were majority of them were not in favor of a net neutrality repeal. In fact, they wanted to strengthen net neutrality protections, but it was these lobbying groups and these kind of shady, consortiums of the communications industry that were submitting the majority of these comments. And many of them were just the same thing, copied over and over. In the analysis, Stanford says that if a person used a unique message, they were much more likely to actually be in favor of defending net neutrality than they were of repealing it.
The FCC's public comment process was corrupted by millions of fake comments on net neutrality. This is from the New York State officials. The law protects New Yorkers from deception and the misuse of their identities. My office will get to the bottom of what happened and hold accountable those responsible for using stolen identities to distort public opinion on net neutrality. The way it works is that when the federal government or a federal government agency wants to redo its rules, the rules are submitted for public comment. And then there's a public comment period. And during that time period, people, whether they're for or against the new rules, whether they're for them in whole or in part, they get a chance to speak. Now, the comment period, Chris, is important for a couple reasons. One is the agency that wants to revise the rules, in this case, getting rid of net neutrality, can say, look, public opinion basically supports us. Now, of course, in this case, who in the public, I mean, who's not a, you know, doesn't have a proprietary interest, would want to have their computer searches slowed down? I mean, who would say, yeah, that's a really great idea. I want to be able to pay to navigate on the internet so I can go to the same sites. I mean, just on its face, logically, it doesn't make any sense. I want to ask you about that, and then I want to ask you a follow-up question.
Yeah, and the Stanford study said that, you know, most people were aware of what net neutrality was and how the repeal would have a negative impact on their lives. I think people are smarter than they are given credit for very, you know, often. And when it's explained simply like that, it's very clear where people stand and what they want in this case.
There were some pro net neutrality organizations that have also been named in the probe. But what you're saying is that the overwhelming, and I think what this article is saying, what the investigation is showing, is that the overwhelming number of perhaps fake comments were done by those who want to get rid of net neutrality. And Ajit Pai, the head of the FCC, immediately jumped on it and said, see, the people support paying higher prices for their access to the internet. See, but the next question that I wanted to ask you as a follow-up is that after the comment period ends, the agency, whatever the agency is in the federal government, it can promulgate new rules. And then the only recourse will be for the public or organizations advocating on behalf of the public to go to court, to litigate. And the public comments thus become part of the public record around which the litigation occurs. So is net neutrality, Chris, is it being challenged right now in the courts? And what's the status of the movement to try to end this terrible, awful decision by the Trump administration to end net neutrality?
The primary challenge to the net neutrality rollback is actually sort of a reverse challenge. Shortly after the FCC's new rules, the government of California approved net neutrality effectively in the state. And immediately there were lawsuits against California, the government of California, to repeal its new protections, right? So it's kind of a backwards defense of net neutrality. But when that lawsuit goes through, if California is successful, it could have a very important impact across the country, where states are more likely to pass these same protections after California has proven that these protections are constitutional. And so it could actually go that way.
We have about 3.5 minutes left. Let's go on to our next story.
Okay, well, I want to share some good news. I often hear that we don't share enough good news on this segment. So
that's what we say about all of our segments, by the way.
Well, here's something good. This is coming from the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation. And again, we're going to California here. Open access is the law in California. Governor Brown recently signed a bill, AB 2192, that requires peer-reviewed scientific research funded by the state of California to be made public. Now, it makes sense, right? If something is publicly funded, this research, then why shouldn't it be made available freely to the public? Unfortunately, in the realm of corporate academia, that's not always the case. And so it's very important that this is the case. This is now passed in California, and there are many, obviously, universities in California that are putting out really important research on a number of scientific topics. And this really needs to become the law across the country, not just in California.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We have this segment every Monday here on Loud and Clear. We talk about the big issues in technology. Here's a story. Now, it's from Bloomberg Businessweek. Now apps can track you even after you uninstall them. What?
Yeah. And this has been something that has especially been prevalent on the Android side, although apparently they have figured it out on the iOS side as well, that a number of these advertising agencies can use these sort of individual identification numbers on your phones and other techniques to track you even after you deleted an app, right? Maybe it was a game, maybe it was just something you didn't need anymore. And then you're going to see more ads for that app or maybe related ones that they're also tied to. So they find out when you've stopped using them or when you've actually deleted them directly. And then they've tied that to your device. And then you're surfing the internet, you're looking at, some web page and you see an ad. And all of a sudden there's an ad for that game or that app to get you to try to reinstall it. Very scary, and it's a complete violation of trust and privacy.
Chris Garaffa, we have about 90 seconds left. You always take us out with a technology tip. What is it?
So this week, our technology tip is to back up your files. There are two types of files on your computer. There are the ones that are backed up, and there are the ones that you're going to lose. So it's so important to back up if you have, just even your photos, your email, your financial information, whatever it is you've got on your computer. It's so important to back it up. It can be as simple as going to a computer store and buying an external hard drive, plug it in and just drag your stuff over to it. Both macOS and Windows have built-in backup systems that might actually pop up when you plug in a new drive just to say, hey, do you want to use this to back up? Now, if you want to get a little more advanced, you should also have a backup in a different place. Buy two hard drives, back up stuff, and then bring it to your office or a trusted friend's or family's house so that if there's a natural disaster and your computer and the backup you have at home get destroyed, at least you have one that might be a little bit older, but you have one off-site so that, like I said, in case of a natural disaster, you still have access to your data. So that would be the tech tip. Back up your stuff. It's very easy to do, and you never know when disaster will strike.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was Chris Garaffa. We're joined by Chris every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. Chris Garaffa joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR. CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.